Tonight on Arena, James Norton on his role in the film Joy, and we review the new production of The Borrowers, this year's Christmas show at the Gate Theatre. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. For many people, the challenges of infertility are solved by a process called in vitro fertilisation, or IVF. It's estimated that as a result of this scientific breakthrough, millions of babies have been born the world over. The origins of the technique go back to the late 1970s. They were humble, and the success was hard won. This story is told in the film Joy, which lands on Netflix this weekend. In the film, James Norton, Thomasin McKenzie and Bill Nye star as scientists Robert Edwards and Jean Purdy and obstetrician Dr. Patrick Steptoe. I spoke with James Norton recently about his role in the film, along with his work in Happy Valley as Tommy Lee Royce and his upcoming work on a new series about the Guinness family. Before we hear that conversation, let's have a clip from the film Joy as Robert and Jean, that's James Norton and Thomasin McKenzie, try to get Bill Nye's Dr. Steptoe to join forces with them.
You teach at Cambridge, Dr. Edwards, is that right?
I do.
All my clinical material is in Oldham. Cambridge is 200 miles away.
Well, in the short term, we'll set up at yours. It's only a 4-hour drive. And in the long term, we'll get money from the Medical Research Council and move you south. That is, if you're willing to be moved south.
I could be persuaded.
We'll need women. Women willing to contribute ovarian tissue.
I have some hysterectomy patients, so if I explain what we're doing, might be prepared to help us.
Oh, he's not just got the skills, he's also got the contact.
You're aware they'll throw the book at us. The church, the state, the world. We will unite them all against us.
But we'll have the mothers. The mothers will back us.
Right. If I don't go now, I'll miss the 5:25, and I'll never be home. Oh, Jean.
You're in, aren't you?
We'll speak soon, I hope.
James Norton, who plays the character of Robert Edwards in the film Joy. Welcome to Arena, James. Lovely to have you with us this evening. I believe that when you read this script initially, it was a very swift response. Yes, I want to do it.
It was, yeah. I was coming off the back of a play and it was a very intense piece and everyone I know was saying, have a holiday, take a break. And then annoyingly, or not annoyingly, fortuitously, this script landed and it was a dream job. You know, Jack Thorne, Rachel Mason wrote it, incredible, beautiful script, great producers, Fernando Dwyer and Amanda Posey produced some of my favourite movies, Brooklyn and others. And then, of course, Bill Nye and Thomasin McKenzie, like I'm fans from afar of those two. And then since we've become really close friends and it was, yeah. So my holiday had to be delayed, but I was very happy to delay it for this particular movie.
Yeah, you say you were coming back off the back of a play. You were indeed coming back off the back of a play, The Rule of Jude, St. Francis, in Ivo van Hove's version of Hanya Yanagihara's devastating book, it must be said, a Little Life. When you said your friends were saying you needed to take a break, did you think, you know, taking a break from the intensity of that character and playing it in the theatre, obviously, for such a long time as well, is a change of style, if you like, because in comparison to characters, I mean, Robert is, yeah, he's a really good guy.
He's a really good guy. I mean, I think Jude St. Francis is also a really good guy and actually is a force for good. I mean, it, you know, the fact that that play is and that book is really about redemptive love and friendship, and the people around you see this beauty in this character and they feel it's worth loving him out of his pain. But as you say, Bob Edwards is a very different kettle of fish. You know, he's a good man doing a good thing for the greater good, you know, alongside Patrick and particularly Jean Purdy. They all gave so much. Bob had 5 daughters, you know, and when he says, I didn't see my family and my wife, he really was up and down that. They both, him and Jean, were up and down that road to Oldham, 4-hour drive. So, yeah, he is a good guy. And actually, I think initially I was scared to take on a job so quickly, but what I realized quite soon after we started was that Bob Edwards was exactly what I needed after Jude St. Francis. I needed the antithesis to that play. The atmosphere of that play was really hard and grueling. And I think if I'd sat on my own and gone to a beach and wallowed, I'm not sure I would have been able to extract myself as quickly and as seamlessly as I did. When I hang out with Bill Nighy and Thomas and Mackenzie is a wonderful salve for anything. And we had a really, really special summer. And, you know, playing Bob, this enthusiastic Labrador, was just great.
I love you that you call him a Labrador. He is a little bit obsessed, it must be said, with labs and laboratories. He was himself and the Bill Nighy character and the Thomas and Mackenzie character, the three of them were really at the forefront of the scientific breakthrough that led to IVF. Ironically, at the time, they got hell. They got a lot of stick for what they were doing.
Yeah, they did. And I think, you know, this film is one of those strange films where there isn't an antagonist. But of course, what it does pay tribute to is the fact that there was an enormous pushback against this science, particularly from the church and conservative groups. There was fear because it was the unknown. And, you know, the scene with James Watson is really interesting because, you know, he really epitomizes a really dark kind of opinion on what this particular science could lead to. And they had to fight against that. And almost as this film, as it sort of describes it, almost beat them. But they persevered. And that's why it's such a beautiful story, because over this 10-year window, they fought so hard. But yeah, there was prejudice, and there still is some prejudice. And hopefully this film is a, you know, it really brings home how wonderful and important this science is and how much joy it brings to so many different people. And despite that pushback.
One of the challenges I would have thought is that there's a lot of science, obviously, in the piece, and you have to give us some very technical type of explanations of things that are happening in the lab. Doing that in a way that it's delivered by a human, how much of a challenge was that? Because you obviously have to make Bob Robert into this human being rather than, you know, an arid, dry scientist.
Yeah, I mean, when I first read the tagline before I read the script, you know, and it, you always get a little kind of pithy one-liner saying, you know, this is a film about these three scientists who discovered IVF. And I remember my initial thought was like, how is that going to be at all interesting? You know, this is going to be three people looking through microscopes and prodding Petri dishes for an hour and a half. I don't know what the conflict is. Where's the story? And actually, there's something really wonderful about watching people who are good at their craft do something, and you know they are brilliant. They were the best at that time. You know, there were other projects going on in Australia and America at the same time, and Bob, Patrick, and Jean were the ones who really saw it through. And so they are like virtuosos in that particular field. And so we needed to be really good as well. And what was great about this film was that, you know, they provided us with the right support, which is, you know, good producers. As an actor, you are so grateful to them. And we had this woman called Brooke Wilson, who was an embryologist, who came and gave us all the guidance we needed on the science.
And I believe you visited an IVF clinic in Guy's Hospital in London to kind of get a sense of things there.
I did, which was fascinating. Again, you know, that was provided by the producers, and I went and hung out with, you know, modern embryologists and watched these huge screens with, you know, needles entering into eggs, extracting DNA to then test to see if the fertilized embryo was, you know, worth freezing. I mean, the science blew my mind, and it was humbling and very moving to see where the breakthrough that Bob, Patrick, and Jean, you know, the how far that had become, and it is accessible to many people now. Not accessible enough, but, you know, it's getting there, and hopefully this film might encourage people to increase that access.
I did wonder, however, the fact that Bob has to travel from Cambridge with Jean Pardee, the two of them travel from Cambridge up to Oldham, you know, very regularly. What is it, 180, 190 miles, something like that. Were you tempted at any point to just go over to the other side of Manchester and take a look around Bolton and get back into the head of Tommy Lee?
You know, your lads have been visiting me in Sheffield.
What's that got to do with anything?
Nothing. I'm telling you somewhere else now. You'd been visiting me.
Yeah, I know all about it.
No, you don't.
Oh, you think cops and prison officers don't talk to each other?
What, and you've let him?
No, I didn't let him, but I do know all about it. And you know what? I'm pleased. Pleased he's been visiting you.
Good, well, I'm pleased that you know.
Because he's had a chance to see through you. And it's been a real pleasure to me watching the scales fall away from his eyes.
See through me?
I take it Marbella's off the menu. I take it that's why you're in my kitchen.
What do you mean, see through me? There's nothing to see through.
I mean that he knows for himself now that there's not a lot going on up here and that you're not someone to trust.
Oh, that's just shit.
And that you're not even interested.
I've never lied to him about anything.
You tried to persuade him to go on the run with you, for fuck's sake.
Because I wanted to spend a bit of time with him, because someone, oh yeah, you, never even let me know he'd been born.
That character you played in Happy Valley, the nemesis of Sarah Lancashire's Catherine Carwood.
I'm trying to think of like the kind of hybrid Bob Edwards, the world in which Bob Edwards meets Tommy Lee Royce. That's a, that's an interesting kind of conundrum, an interesting prospect. We did actually head up one day in that scene when Thomas and I are sitting looking across this beautiful vista. We did shoot that up in. Up somewhere near Manchester. I can't remember. I think it was in the Pennines because we couldn't find a place which looked like the north. The northern viewers will be very pleased that we couldn't find the raw beauty in the south. So we had to go on this one day trip up north. Tommy Lee Royce had his time and it was a very special time. But unfortunately, if you've watched the third series, you'll know that Tommy is not part of my life anymore.
Very nicely put, James, without spoiling it on anybody. What happens next for you? You've had the joy of this. I know there's another big Netflix series coming up about something close to this country's heart, the Guinness family.
Yeah, I'm currently playing a man from Dublin, a very Irish, very proud man who, he's the foreman to the Guinness family. So it's 1860s and... it's a sort of Stephen Knight drama about the Guinness family and when their brand exploded onto the world stage. So, yeah, it's a really fun job. Stephen's writing is immaculate. Netflix behind it again, and they're a great, great sort of streamer and studio to work with. So, yeah, watch this space, but we're having a lot of fun making it.
Thanks so much for being with us this evening, James.
Thank you very much. Take care.
James Norton there talking to us about the film Joy, which will be available on Netflix from this Friday, November the 22nd. And important to acknowledge, as Sean in Newbridge tells us, don't forget, it's not always joy, it's not always successful. And indeed, that side of IVF is treated within the film Joy as well, as you will see if you go to watch it on Netflix, available from Friday. Now, at a gathering in Paris just last week, an Irish composer walked away with the greatest European honour for composers in film and television. Anna Rice won the Camille Award for Best Score for a Feature Documentary for the documentary I Dream in Photos. It follows the life of photojournalist Cathal McNaughton, who, having quit his job at the peak of his career, reflects on what he has borne witness to over the years. It was directed by Ollie Aslin and Gary Lennon. In fact, we spoke to Gary Lennon and Cathal McNaughton on the show last December at the time of the cinema release of the documentary, if I remember right. Anna's work over the last 20 years has extended across feature film, documentary, orchestral composition, TV animation, and lots of other genres as well. She is the first ever Irish composer to win a Camille Award. In fact, this is the first year that an Irish composer has ever been nominated. And I'm delighted that Anna Rice is with me in studio this evening. So there you are. It bigged you up in terms of that. It must have been a great joy to, you know, this is a big award in terms of film composition. For it to land into your lap like this must have been quite joyous.
It did feel like it landed in my lap. It felt like a gift. Just it's such a subjective process. And I just felt the process was... it was a three-stage sort of adjudication process where the Screen Composers Guild of Ireland chose in each category, which was TV, feature film score, and then feature documentary. So we were invited to send our scores in. I was embarrassed even doing that my peers were going to watch my work. It was just so encouraging that they chose to put it forward then to the European jury, which is... European composers of other guilds in Europe who watched it as well. And I don't know to what their system was. They graded it. And then I think possibly out of 12 entrants from all over Europe in each category, they picked three to go forward for nomination and invited those three to Paris. And then there was an international jury made up of members. There was a whole other league of another worrying about them were watching my work, listening. I think it was the first time I've had a head-on examination of my work at that sort of tier. So
that's extraordinary because, as I said, you have worked across all sorts of genres and you've been working. You know, it isn't as if you started this last year. You've been working at it for two decades
now. It's a slow-burning career,
You know, and when I list off some of the names that you've worked in, not necessarily within film and animation, but Lang Lang is in there, Ronnie Wood is in there, The Chieftains, Donal Lunny, Moxie Andrea-Carr, a whole... Mm. Like that just scrapes the surface of it. I'm kind of surprised that you're worried about your peers looking at your work or listening to your work. I suppose.
You know, it's what makes me tick. I think absolutely, it's a huge encouragement. You know, when you're working on your own, you're in isolation for months on end. Mm. Your comrades are the people you're working with on the film. You're in a microcosm, and your life is. You're only thinking about that project at the time. You're not. Yeah, I think the experience obviously builds up and you've got confidence to speak your mind about what you think the film needs or doesn't need in the music. You know, I hope I can enjoy more confidence just in those collaborations now. And
I haven't got the stamp of approval from the several juries.
It's European, it's just really encouraging. But it did feel like a gift. It's just when he read my name out, I was like,
did he mean
seriously?
Me?
could he?
I wondered about the aspect of, because this is a documentary. Now, you've worked in feature film, you've worked in animation. Mm. Is documentary, when it comes to composition, is documentary, has it got a particular, not set of rules, but what are the challenges and what are the aspects of documentary that make film scoring? Or what does it put in front of you?
Sure, good question. This film, when Gary showed me rough cuts of I Dream in Photos, it was the most cinematic documentary I think I've ever seen. I think a lot, documentary can be so many things. You can have very low-key, fly-on-the-wall, you know, like making a murderer, discovering all that in the course of a documentary and filming, you know, right from scratch. This was really unique because it was made up of stills. The visuals, and they were mind-blowing and arresting.
Yeah, these were coupled with, you know,
from
really difficult conflict situations.
Absolutely.
Of conflict.
You know, and the way Iseult Howlett, the editor, is just unbelievably razor sharp in her decisions. Yeah, the way they cut it was just so. You know, there weren't dramatic fades from one picture to the next. There was no glamorization. It was just like. Another one that just arrests your soul.
Yeah, the images, Kyle MacLachlan's images within the documentary are hugely important.
Unbelievable,
And then there's also the aspect of him talking to camera about, you know, winning the Pulitzer Prize and deciding, I'm out of here. I'm going home to Cushendall. Yeah. And he brings us through all of that story. So there are lots of things going on.
Yeah.
But obviously he was a war photographer. He was taking his pictures in conflict zones. Mm. And one of the aspects that you had to get is the kind of an adrenaline rush that he speaks about in that particular...
In one or two places,
I want to listen to a piece called Pack Mentality. And we'll hear, this is from the film itself, so we'll hear the music in situ with the voice of Cathal MacNaughton coming in then afterwards.
It can be frightening to see pack mentality or group mentality. It's like a living organism and it has its own mind. It's like the collective becomes the singular and they all start behaving in a certain way. And it can be awesome to watch in the true sense of the word, but very frightening.
You know, your heart is literally beating.
how difficult it is to run with a flak jacket and a gas mask on. I truly, truly knew about running for your life.
There is so much adrenaline running through your body that, you know, you're high.
There from the documentary film I Dream in Photos. We're talking to Anna Rice, the composer of the score, winning composer, award-winning composer, won the best score for a feature documentary, Camille Award, recently, and is with us in studio this evening. He talks in the middle of that, the voice of Cathal McNaughton, the journalist, or the photojournalist that we're hearing in the midst of that, Anna, and he talks about your heart is literally beating out of your body, and you start with that rumbling bass, and it kind of builds over the sequence right through that.
Sure.
What I remember is, yes, we hear his voice, but we're seeing these still images.
Absolutely, yeah. It's,
and that's kind of, in some ways, were you scoring the movement of the still images as they on the screen?
I think we did go back and forth a little bit. Yeah, the three of us, Gary, Sult and myself on this. It was, it was worthy of discussion because it was mainly stills with some source material footage from real life, and then Cathal, his own, maybe it was his GoPro footage, you know, he's crawling under a fence to try and escape a situation. There's a line in the film, it could be just before that clip, where he says you don't see bullets.
Yes.
You know, you don't see the bullet coming towards you. He could just be taken out at any moment.
Yeah, the danger, is very real. And the music really creates that.
Yeah,
that
there's not too much of that style music in it, but it was to honour what Cathal described. You know, he became addicted to the adrenaline of it, and it took more and more and more to rouse his, excitement. And the rest of the score is completely different in that it's, it was the first time I actually played on one of my own scores quite substantially, because I just would always hire a violinist better than me. But there was something about the brokenness of the tone that I was laying down in these demos that felt like the most direct emotional route, that if when we tried to gloss things up, it just felt like trying to comfort the audience or trying to distract or something. And Gary just, this was real life. This wasn't a recreation of refilmed anything. We just had to let it be, you know.
One of the things that Cathal says at different points along the way, he talks about when you're trying to get that moment, how there's all this madness going around you, but in fact, you have to be absolutely still and absolutely silent. And it struck me, you're quite right, that isn't emblematic of the piece we just heard, isn't typical of the score. Mm-hmm. But it struck me that maybe as a composer, ironically, what you were searching for a lot of the time was the silence, or just the smallest amount of music that you could put in there.
Yeah, exactly. I remember, actually, it's a little different to your question, but I just felt like I had to remind myself that these are still images. There's so much movement in his shots, and especially on the big screen. He said there's some line like, I want them to feel like snapshots, like you're really there. I've never noticed that about anything, just that context before, but absolutely, I felt like the music had loads of movement to mirror and to latch on with, and the momentum within, it sounds crazy, momentum within a photo. I felt like that's what I was really
channeling. Yeah, and you're not just talking about, you know, one still going to another still going to another still. You're talking about, even when we get to look at stills for quite a long period of time, there's action within that
and
still.
They change without you expecting them, and it's done so quietly, and so, and then you're reacting to a new image. It was really unique.
I want to play, again, I'm going to play the clip from the film first, but then I want to go back to the music itself as a separate entity. This is a scene where Cathal is talking about a photograph of a mother holding a three-week-old baby in her arms. This is in Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh. She was a member of the Rohingya people, and they had fled. The baby in her arms is dying. And as we'll hear Cathal explain within this clip, it doesn't end well for anybody, really.
I've got a funny relationship with this particular picture because the story behind it is really tragic, but I also think it is one of the most beautiful pictures I've ever taken. It's difficult to say that, but it's true. I can't help my feelings towards the picture and the composition. the light, the colours, and she is staring straight at you. You can stare at her, you can look into her very soul, you know her story. If that doesn't make you think or reevaluate things, then I haven't done my job and I've failed Manara as well and her child.
Even just as he describes it there, and we go on to hear that, in fact, the baby did die. I mean, it's absolutely tragic, the tale that he's telling there. You were saying before we came to air that this is one of the most difficult pieces you've ever had to score.
Absolutely, and I'm sure ever probably will have to. Mm. And it's real life, you know, and it was real life. And before actually that point in that queue, Cathal is merely giving context. We're looking at the photo and he's talking about who she was, Manara Begum, and the context of the child. And the music is, I couldn't do anything. That was what we just heard would be far too much for that. When we're just looking at that woman and imagining everything, and the music was just, it's like, we can only be lost for words here. I can't comment on any of this. And then when Cathal starts to talk about the artistry and the photo a little bit, we say, yeah, there's a license there to just, you know, take us through something.
I want to bring that music again in underneath. Now, the music is available as an album as well. The score is available as an album. And I want to listen to that, this original music from that album, because you talked about your own playing of the violin within the midst of this.
Yeah.
And it's quite a different thing, I'm sure, when you take the music out of context and listen to it in that way. Is it very different for you to do that?
You mean in...
When you listen to the music totally separate from the visuals.
Yeah. I think the approach to this was different from anything I've done. When I'm recording myself or recording anyone else, we can capture the sound in the computer, and you can improve it. I actually denatured.
Well, I want to listen to your violin playing, which is just coming up now. I had it playing underneath us there. Absolutely beautiful. That is Manara Begum from the album, from the soundtrack to the film I Dream in Folds, music by Anna Rice, who's with me in studio this evening. I was asking you about that melody that we hear in the violin, yourself playing it, Anna. I wondered, was it a folk melody? Where did it come from?
There wasn't any, I think very little cerebral input from me. I just played to it. I had harmonic backing and I just ached and played my violin a little bit, and then I orchestrated around it. We put down the orchestra around it.
You were playing the violin just at that melody line, with nothing else around
just
it. And
how
then
I
you
felt.
Did it after.
The picture beside me maybe did a couple of takes. That's not me at all. This process is.
Because I mentioned some of the other things you've been involved in, not least of which is the world of animation. Was it like a half an hour of animation a week? You'd be scoring on a regular basis.
Yeah.
That's full on, I would have thought.
Yeah, by my first series, I really thought I might not come out of this alive, but unbelievably fun and wonderful to be employed for a year. It's a different, very different part of my brain, certainly.
And I would say, you know, get it done, get it out, and get it stuck in.
But you do get addicted to the pace and just the adrenaline of getting things done.
Finally, one final question. I see Lang Lang, upcoming, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Sword of Destiny.
Yes, not upcoming.
Oh, sorry, gone in the past.
It was in the past. Okay, so this was one of the more extreme delights, but extreme in every way experiences. For me, I had done one job with Shigeru Umabayashi, who's a Japanese composer of many unbelievable Chinese films. House of Flying Daggers was the first time I'd seen his work. I just I couldn't. I still haven't got it out of my head after 20 years. He had invited me to orchestrate his violin concerto for Gidon Kremer, and we'd been in Germany doing that. Amazing. We said we just got on so well, and English obviously isn't his first language, but he communicates so well.
You spoke music to each other.
We did. And that I had no expectations of, you know, I just thought that was a gorgeous experience. Said bye, and then he rang me on a Sunday afternoon to say, I knew he was working on Crouching Tiger, which is particularly, I'm fascinated by all that. And he invited me to collaborate on the theme song. So by the Friday we were in Taipei, having orchestrated, and I helped him with the lyrics. Yeah. He'd got some of it done.
Nice way.
So Lang Lang was the pianist of engagement there. So.
Lovely to speak with you. Congratulations again on the award.
Thank you so much.
That's Anna Rice. I Dream in Photos, by the way, the documentary itself, there's a version of it to watch on the RTE player. Mm-hmm. And you can listen to Anna's music, obviously, within the film itself, or if you go to Spotify, and I'm sure it's available on other platforms as well. I Dream in Photos, Anna Rice, you'll see that and material from other films as well. Thank you so much for being with us, and congratulations on that win. Based on Mary Norton's beloved 1950s adventure novels, The Borrowers follows the fortunes of the tiny clock family who live secretly in the nooks and crannies and floorboards of a country house, surviving off the items they borrow from the big people, or as they call them, the human beans. And yes, that's B-E-A-N-S. Playwright Charles Way adapted Norton's novels for the stage. This week, the Irish premiere of The Borrowers opened at the Gate Theatre. This show was directed by the Gate's artistic director, Roisin McBrien, and features songs written and composed by Fionn Foley. Sunita Apiakarang went along to the opening night for us, and she's with me in studio this evening. I think everybody would probably remember the story of The Borrowers, but this idea of this tiny little clock family who take things from the big people and live in the nooks and crannies of a house, it's a wonderful idea, just which it was originally as a story, a novel.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're probably the original sustainability influencers if you had to take inspiration from
them. They were repurposing everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Back in the 1940s and 50s.
Exactly. And we're returning to the same ethos. In actual fact, I really enjoyed the play. It was wonderful. And I really, there was a throwback to TK Red, which I remember drinking as a kid, when Arietti Clock, who's the main protagonist, had an overalls with that. And I was like, gosh, yeah, that's really throwing it way back.
Yes, because while The Borrowers in those original novels is a very British type of thing, has it been brought into an Irish setting? Is it modernised?
It's not modernised in terms of time per se, but it's modernised definitely in terms of the medium that it uses to create that contrast between the miniature world that the clocks live in. So the clocks, they're named, their surnames are given to them based on the actual dwelling places that they inhabit. So in this case, the family live in a grandfather or underneath a grandfather clock in this big Victorian house. And it's implied that this grand Victorian house is in the countryside in Ireland somewhere, because one of the characters in the story, a little boy called Tom, comes to visit from dirty old Dublin and the city air there, and he's there for a bit of R&R. So implied somewhere in the countryside in Ireland. Yeah.
So we were speaking where you have Irish accents, and I presume Tom arrives with his dub accent.
Exactly, yeah. There was a few jibes thrown in there about, how is he taken to the clean country air compared to Dublin, yeah.
So we have that aspect of things, but you were saying, without spoiling it for people who are going to see it, but they have to find a way of realising these actors on stage who are playing the little people, the tiny people living in the nooks and crannies, but there are also human beings who are part of this story.
Human beings. So yeah, I mean, just to set the tone, I suppose, the Clock family essentially are surviving or rely on the human beings above them for their day-to-day bits. Food, functional things in their little floorboard home. So for instance, a matchbox is repurposed as a stove for them somehow. Like that I was talking about, their clothing. Arietti has like a TK Red wrapper as a dress. Homily, who is the mother character played by Aoife Mulholland, gets a pod, who's the father character, played by Ben Morris, to run up the curtain there and get her a teapot, which is made out of a little slither or a chipping out of their actual teapots in the house. So that's kind of how, and that's the big adventure, I suppose, in the story, is the whole device of trying to get up to the main house without being spotted by human beings, because that is the big existential risk to them, is if they're spotted by humans, they might be squished. And then I guess the whole story is even more intensified because above them lives Mrs. Driver, who's kind of like a Trunchbull type, really grumpy, grouchy, probably OCD character that's trying to figure out how do things keep getting stolen or thieved from the house. Things just disappear all the time.
And Mrs. Driver, she's the housekeeper in the big house up
exactly,
above.
Exactly, yeah.
Played by Ruth McGill.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You're saying not to be messed with is Mrs. Driver.
Not to be messed with, lest she get at you with a duster. And actually speaking to the actors, like, it was so impressive. I guess myself and my friend and her son, Sulliv, went to go see it, and he's 6 years old. So in his case, I think the story was probably entirely new. We had a loose sense of what the story was, having seen it as kids in a movie version of it.
Yeah.
But we were really keen to understand, like, how are they going to execute on this miniature world versus large world? So also just there's so many characters in the book, so how are they going to, like, yeah, the efficiency of actors? So there's only, I think there's 6 actors covering about 10 roles, so like it was really impressive and efficiently done, but also all of them embodied those characters effectively.
And that realization, it's a mixture of projections and tricks, visual tricks on stage that make you think that they're tiny, I'm guessing.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I mean, reading the programme, I think Roisin McBryn and the set designers were kind of thinking of, like, how do we create this essence of a small stage by having, like, wood panels on headers and legs to create this cramped environment and make the miniature people feel small. And then, like, that whenever they climb up the curtain up to the main house, there'd be this expanse of space and the grandfather clock and the kind of, like, wallpaper that signify that old Victorian house style. So yeah, really impressive use of tools of, like, the floorboards and wood panels to kind of evoke that world. But then again, have to give a shout out to the kind of modern digital aspect. I think it was Dick Stracker on the video design that had projections of curtains on their screens, and then, like, little miniature people climbing up them to kind of create that, like, movement.
So we
from
think
one world to another.
We see them as these miniature digital versions of themselves as well. I suppose there is adventure in this. Dad Pods, the father character, goes off on a bit of a wander, and they're all very worried about where he's heading.
Yeah.
But there is a kind of message here about, you know, you can make friends with anybody, really.
Well, yeah, I guess the premise of the story is, I suppose, Arietti Clock is the main protagonist that we encounter, and she's like a teenager that is a bit restless. And
Played by Claire O'Leary.
Claire O'Leary, brilliantly played by Claire O'Leary. And I suppose I'll actually preface with, this is a musical, so we are carried through the story of the clocks through music. I had to say I was so impressed by her singing, incredible performance, and loads of choreography going on as well.
And it is important to give that, because that musical aspect is an added, as well as the Irishization of the setting, that musical element is added. It's
exactly.
The music and lyrics by Fionn Foley. What kind of music are we getting?
I guess, like, in terms of background music, it really did kind of, it gave me that nostalgia feel of watching, like, a cartoon, because you had all of these gorgeous little arpeggiated, you know, piano sounds to create the movement or scurrying of them from one point or another to the house. And then on the other side, yeah, all the songs are like the kind of the emotional tension in it is driven by the music, when Arietti is basically saying that she wants to expand her world beyond the floorboards and see the actual sky for once. So the combination of music and lyrics is really smart. It's quite a witty and fun and playful and light story. So even for non-musical lovers per se, I would say that just even in the logistics of, like, knowing the story loosely and kind of seeing as to how they move people and the devising of, like, stage production and performance, it's enjoyable. But then for anyone that is a musical fan, it very much kind of gave me, like, I don't know what kind of musical I can compare it to, but it certainly took me back to, like, nostalgia and kind of watching 90s films and thinking, this is cozy.
And in terms of the audience, you had a young person with you were saying?
I had a
6-year-old little boy,
his name
it?
Is Sulliv,
Sulliv.
Again, circling back to Ruth McGill and her brilliant acting as Mrs. Driver, the housekeeper, the prissy housekeeper in the house, her anger and scariness at one point nearly finding Arietti at a pivotal moment was so effective that sort of hopped up out of his seat and he was kind of signalling and waving frantically at Arietti to pay attention to behind her lest she get caught. So I was like, okay, this is obviously, you know, we are immersed.
He was totally and absolutely engaged.
Yeah, exactly.
In what he was watching. It sounds as if it's great family fun for the Christmas period.
100%. I mean, look, it's an enjoyable play and a nice day out or evening out with the family. But I think also what was cute as I was like revising the story of this is it is a story about, you know, young people wanting to have a sense of adventure and break out and, you know, test their skills out in the world. But also on the other side of it, it's about, you know, making unlikely friends. And there's a sustainability element there that could be argued. And the values as well of like taking risks every now and again in order to create, you know, new experiences and expand your world. And you know what, your world actually might be a bit more enriching for having taken that chance.
So there are kind of messages, for want of a better phrase, within the piece itself. But essentially, you're not being beaten over the head with the messages.
Absolutely not. No, exactly. Yeah, it's a fun way to get it across.
Just finally, standout performances.
Standout performance? Who was my favourite character?
Standout performances as in terms of the actors.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, across the board, they were, standout across. In fairness, I have to say as well, reading the programme as well, I think four of the six actors, it was their debut in the Gate. So I was thinking, you know, impressive. A lot of them studied in the UK and such. But lucky to have them. Great first performance. Opening night, there was a lovely buzz in the room and all the kids were really excited. So I have to say, if you can and if you want to go see a musical with so many kid companions of your own or children, it's well worth doing so.
All right. And I think they're suggesting for 7+ in and around that, you were saying.
I would probably, Sullivan's about 6. And I think that definitely a lot of the jokes will at least be registered probably at that age and above.
Okay. Yeah. Well, there you go. That's Anita Appiah-Carong talking to us about The Borrowers. It runs at the Gate Theatre right through until January the 12th. So lots of opportunities over the Christmas period. There are also special schools performances during the run and an ISL interpreted matinee on Saturday the 7th of December. But you can find out full details about all of those different times and performances on gatetheatre.ie. The RTE Short Story Competition 2024 in honour of Frances McManus celebrates the extraordinary talent of Irish writers. 10 stories have been selected from nearly 1,500 submissions, and we'll be speaking to each of the authors on Arena and on Friday the 29th of November. We'll get around to all 10 of them at some point along the way. We'll meet the authors in person on that night in the Pavilion Theatre along with the judges, and the winner will be announced on that evening as well. Tonight's author speaking to us from Ottawa in Canada is Alexis MacIsaac. And the first thing they're going to ask me, Alexis, is, I thought this was for Irish writers, but there is a rule and you are in under the rule. You might explain it if you can. If you can't, I can.
Sure. I hold an Irish passport, so yeah. I'm a dual Canadian-Irish citizen.
Yeah. So the important thing is that the qualifying criterion is that you have an Irish passport. You have that. You're a dual citizen. And I'm delighted to hear you will be travelling over for the awards in the Pavilion next Friday.
Yes, I'm very much looking forward to it. I'll be there with my husband.
Ah, very good. Well, I hope you will both enjoy the night, whatever the outcome is. Your story, Alexis, is called The Rehearsal. It was a male a friend, I believe, who came back from a trip to Cuba. Was certainly one of the starting points for this?
Yeah, that's right. So the story was inspired by a conversation I had with a friend of mine who had just come back from Cuba. And we were talking and he was telling me about his trip. And he told me that from what he witnessed, buying sex in that country is a very casual affair and that the general attitude regarding the industry is quite non-judgmental. And I thought that was such a fascinating observation. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized it would be worthwhile exploring that issue through fiction by two characters who hold opposing views on the subject. So that's how the story... that's how this seed was planted, I suppose.
And the other thing that you throw that into the mix, certainly, it's called The Rehearsal. There are two musicians involved in the story itself.
Yeah.
You have a background in music yourself.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I'm a violinist. The two characters, neither of them are violinists. One's a guitarist and one's a vocalist, but I do have a music background, yes.
There you go. That's your second violinist we've had on the programme this evening. We're full of them, full of them this evening. Let's have a listen to the opening section of your story, The Rehearsal.
It's dark now. The blackout happened while I was waiting for my accompanist to arrive for rehearsal. Another elderly limb must have thrown itself against a power line when it dislocated from its trunk. 20 minutes later, my door swings open with a sigh, and an unexpected voice calls out from my entryway. "Hello, I'm here." I follow the gravelly sound. It's Joseph, my guitarist. He's thrust his hulking body into my alcove and is so close that I can smell his livid sweat and his parched breath. I take a step back, but he takes a step closer. Joseph is a man accustomed to filling up space as if others should contort themselves to accommodate him, an arrogance innate to large men who look down upon the rest of us. "The whole block is out," he says. "Trees uprooted. Your neighbors are going to be pissed about their dented Teslas." Some people like being pissed. Gives them a sense of purpose.
There we go. That is Tierra Porter reading the opening section of Alexis MacIsaac's story, The Rehearsal. And Alexis, as I say, joining us from Ottawa in Canada this evening. Is that the first time that you have heard the story read aloud, or a section of it read aloud?
Yeah, and wow, that actress is amazing. I couldn't have asked for a better voice, so... yeah, that was incredible.
Yeah, she has a lovely quality in the way she delivers the story. But one of the things that really develops as the story goes on, there's a blackout, as we heard there, and the neighbours won't be too happy about their Teslas getting messed up. But the blackout kind of adds a sort of tension to this piece, in that everything's happening in a shadowy type of situation, and there's quite a bit of tension, all kinds of tension, between the two characters here, the narrator and Joseph.
Yes, no, exactly. There are multiple layers. So there's the blackout, there's the opposing views on the subject of sex work. There are different approaches to music. So the narrator is someone who is interested in precision and arrangements, and Joseph is someone who embraces chaos. And then there's an undercurrent of sexual tension too between the two characters. So there are multiple there are multiple layers of tension operating simultaneously.
Yeah, it did strike me. There are times when the slightest little touch of skin on skin, you know, somebody stretching across to get something off a table and there happens to be a touch of hands or something like that. Suddenly it was electric. You know, this kind of electric atmosphere in that regard. How much did you write that way up and then have to pare it right back down to get to those moments of very high tension with the smallest of movements?
Yes. The first draft of the story was significantly longer. And then I realized that if I pared back the narrative significantly, that would actually elevate the narrative tension. So, yeah, so to answer your question, I ended up doing a number of rewrites to land where I ended up.
Yeah, and you went into the old adage, less is more, and you certainly found that out as you progressed. You mentioned your background in music. You toured with Riverdance and the High Kings. In fact, did that help you with the musical elements here, or did you just feel you just wanted the music in there? How did that work?
Well, I guess I have experience as a musician, so it was familiar territory for me to write about that subject. But I wouldn't say that my experience in Riverdance or the High Kings specifically informed this particular story. But just as an aside, I have the fondest memories touring with those shows. It was an incredible experience for me.
Yeah, and the dual citizenship, does that come from your time with that, or does it come some other way?
No, it comes from my grandmother. She was from Banbridge, and the whole family ended up immigrating to Canada.
All right, so Banbridge, County Down, and hence you hold the dual passport, or the passport, as they say. Finally, having your story read like that, has that been an experience? It's quite, I think, unique to this competition. Did that make you write in any different way?
It did, actually, because I feel like I had a strong sense of voice as I was writing the story, and I was imagining someone reading it aloud. A good practice I inherited from one of my mentors is to read your piece aloud, because you do, you know, you do catch things that way. But that, as I said, that was the first time I've heard an actress read my piece aloud, and that was amazing. I couldn't have asked for a better reader.
Well, I'm sure you will be tuning in tonight to Late Date at 11:20 p.m. our time. What's that, about 20? Is it 20 past 6 or 20 past 5 in the evening with you? So you don't have to stay up too late to get to listen to it. Thanks for being with us this evening, Alexis.
Thank you so much.
And looking forward to seeing you at that event in the pavilion on Friday the 29th. That's Alexis McIsaac, tonight's RTE Short Story Finalist. Alexis' story, The Rehearsal, will be read in full by Tierra Porter on Late Date tonight at 11:20 p.m. You can read it and all of the 10 stories in the final on RTE_culture.ie. Don't forget that Friday the 29th, Arena will host the RTE Short Story Competition final in the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary. I'll be joined on the night by the finalists, all 10 of them. This year's judges, Neil Hegarty, Kathleen McMahon and Claire Kilroy. And we'll have music from the Finches on the night as well. If you would like to join us in the audience, get full details of how to get your tickets on pavilionthatre.ie. And that is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Leah Murphy was the researcher. Broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton. Harry Buchlis was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTÉ Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.